From playing rock, paper, scissors, or gambling, to complex ethical decisions like the trolley problem and self-driving cars, how aware are we when we make choices? Whether it's innate or taught, game theory and choice theory are hugely important and impactful in our modern era, but so too did they play an essential role in the ancient world. Today's Classical Wisdom Speaks podcast is with Josiah Ober, the Mitsutake's professor at the School of Humanities and Sciences, professor of political science and classics, and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's also the author of the recently released book, The Greeks and the Rational, The Discovery of Practical Reason, of which we'll be speaking about today. But before we get started, a quick shout out to our Classical Wisdom members for all of your support. And if you're not a member, please go to classicalwisdom.substack.com to sign up for our free newsletter and also to learn how you can join our awesome classics-loving community. Now, on to Practical Reason, a capital P and a capital R.
All right, so as I was just saying, you have done a really exciting job of sort of combining very different fields. And I think as a result, a very good place to start for my audience will be actually with really modern concepts. And then we'll kind of go back because my listeners, you're probably a little bit more familiar with the Greeks. Game theory might, at least if you're like me, you need a little bit of a recap. So your book is called The Greeks and the Rational and the Discovery of Practical Reason. But let's figure out exactly what practical reason is. Like, let's define the terms. So I'd love to begin with sort of instrumental and practical rationality and how that connects with decision theory and game theory and social choice theory.
For sure. So if we think about rationality, we can think about it as really the correct use of reason for some purpose. And we can sort of divide it up. I think the purposes that we tend to think of for rationality, we have scientific reasoning. And in that case, the goal is truth of some sort. That is the correct answer to some question about reality, or say mathematics. So then we have a second form of reasoning is ethical reasoning, which basically asks you to think about the right ends. What are the goals you're aiming at, and why are those good goals, or why are they the right goals? Why are they the best goals for you to have? And the third form is instrumental or practical reasoning. And this just asks about the correct means or the best available means to accomplish a goal that you already have. So it's really practical in the sense of asking how to get what it is that you might want. So this requires really that you actually have your preferences aligned in some way, not about right preferences, but it is about organized preferences. So if you want one thing at this moment and 10 seconds later, you really want something else, and 20 seconds after that, you really decide you want the other thing. You don't have, as it were, organized preferences. And therefore, we would say that you're not rational in this practical kind of sense. And it requires that you have reasonably organized or at least coherent beliefs about the state of the world. So that gets us back to scientific reasoning. But at any rate, you have to have sort of a conception about how the world works. It isn't simply chaotic. If we have organized preferences, coherent beliefs, then you're able to come up with a set of options that are available to you, is the notion. And this is where decision and game theory comes in, because really what decision and game theory are about is how do you figure out what the best option is? Yeah. So in decision theory, it's basically you're thinking about just one person trying to make a decision, and you abstract away from other people. And in that case, the question really often comes down to probability as well as preference strength. So how much do you want something times how likely it is that you can get it? So you might actually decide to go for your third best of the available options because it's really likely you'll get that rather than some really bad option. Whereas, you know, your best option, 2% chance you'll get that. Second best, 5% chance you'll get that. But an 80% chance that you'll get your third best, you might decide, I'll go for the third best. So that's how sort of decision theory works roughly. And then game theory adds other people into the picture. So in a game theory, you have to ask yourself, what other players, thinking of other people as players in a game, are involved in my getting what I want? And what are their preferences? And what are their beliefs about the state of the world? And in order to get what I want, I'm going to have to take into account what it is that they want, because their choice might block me from getting a particular thing that I might want best. So I may have to go to my second or third best option because you are going to act in a way that will just block me from the, you know, the chance of getting my best. So you have to think about who are the other players in the game. So the basic idea about contemporary decision and game theory is that this skill is in some ways innate. This is what we do a lot, or at least most people do a lot. It's not the only way that we make our choices, but it's something we take into consideration, something we do use. The idea behind turning this into a formal theory is that you can get good at it. You can actually formalize how it goes. And this is what economists do a lot. This is what people who purport anyway to teach you how to be successful in business. It's what people do in military strategizing. They use sort of formal systems that become very then mathematical, because you can get the mathematics can get quite complex if you have multiple players and probabilities and so on. So basically, the idea of game theory and decision theory is how to become a really efficient chooser, how to efficiently get what it is that you want.
Yeah, so it's like people saying how they can hack paper, scissors, rock, that there's mm-hmm. a system to it that then you can always win type thing.
Okay. Yeah. So that you've got to, yeah, when you're doing that, that's very nice, because that is a strategic game. You have to figure out what is the other person going to play. And if they play something that will beat you, then you're going to lose. That also gets involved with the psychology involved. How do I know what you're going to play? So in that, if I'm very good at figuring out your psychology, the way you tend to play, then I'll win very regularly. If I can't figure you out at all, if you have really a good, as it were, poker face, or you completely randomize your choices, then I'll be at a loss.
You can see these are the analogies that you come up with when you spend all your time with seven-year-olds.
Quite.
But, you know, there is a huge element of psychology, because, of course, you know, when I'm playing with my daughter, she's going to have a very different psychological profile than, say, my husband. Not that we're playing paper, scissors, rock very regularly. But, I mean, so this is sort of it's an interesting genre, because you take in the math, you take in the psychology, you take in the philosophy. And then clearly there would be also a whole element of culture that would also determine a lot of these sort of outcomes.
Yeah, and culture really does bring us from the moderns to the ancients in a way, because one of the claims that had long been made is that the ancients, the ancient Greeks or Romans, just don't think this way. They just don't have this kind of mode of cost-benefit analysis. It was said by some that the Greeks and Romans don't even have a conception of probability. They don't really understand how probability works. And so it was sometimes said that this whole approach of decision and game theory is uniquely modern. Maybe uniquely post 17th century when some of the basic mathematical models were worked out, or even uniquely 20th century, a product of, as it were, sort of late capitalism plus nuclear or the nuclear threats. A lot of early game theory, the formalized mathematical form of game theory, was developed in the shadow of nuclear warfare, and it was trying to figure out how to avoid the catastrophe of nuclear conflict. But my argument is that that's not the case, that in fact, the Greek and Roman culture, and I focus on the Greeks, but I think we could do the same kind of story with the Romans, were really quite aware of all of the basic intuitions that go into modern game theory. They don't do the math, right? They don't work out all these very complex mathematical models, at least as far as we know. We've lost so much ancient mathematics. As far as we know, they don't do that. But you don't need to have complex mathematical models to understand, in fact, to become very good at basic strategic reasoning, which is basically what game theory is about.
Isn't military strategies all game theory, or wouldn't it incorporate it so much innately?
Absolutely. Well, yes, when you think about it, that really is one of the primary uses of game theory. And I think both in antiquity and in modernity, Thucydides is just a treasure trove of game theoretic reasoning as soon as you start thinking about him in those terms. But also, Plato and Aristotle, one of the clearest, examples of probability reasoning that I found in philosophical writing of the Greeks is when Plato is talking about how in his ideal best city of Kallipolis in the Republic, he says, well, how will our relatively small virtuous city be able to exist in a world of competitors, big rival city-states? And he has a series of answers to this. But one of the answers is that we're going to give the young citizens special training in military operations that will begin with having them observe battles when they're just children. At which point, Socrates' interlocutor Glaucon says, well, but Socrates, what if they're killed? That would be the end of them and the end of our ideal city. And Socrates says, in effect, the people who will decide whether to send the children out will work out the probabilities. They'll be expert in probability reasoning. We'll only send them out to the safe battles, never to the dangerous battles. And P.S., we'll have a nice insurance plan because we'll mount the children on fast horses. So just in case our estimate of probabilities goes wrong, they'll be able to escape on their horses. But it's again in the military realm that we do see this really trying to work out probabilities. The whole point of that Plato story is that it's a great advantage to Kallipolis to have the children be able to observe. You can't just give that up. So you put some number on that of how good that is, but then you've got to work out the probability that you could lose everything. So you don't want to just give up the advantage, but you certainly don't want to lose the children. And therefore, you've got to make a probability assessment on something like strategic reasoning.
I'd hedge my bets, only send the older kids or the younger kids or, half of them.
Glaucon it's not clear that Glaucon is really completely convinced that this is a great idea, even with the fast horses. But Socrates seems to be very, very convinced by his own reasoning here. And it all hinges on the idea that it's possible to become an expert in estimating probabilities. That is, it's possible to become an expert strategic reasoner.
Yeah, I guess to me, the shocking thing is to think anybody would think that the Greeks didn't have that. Or even the Egyptians, or, you know, because there's so many ways in which we have to calculate probability. I mean, again, like in farming, you have to think, okay, you know, do I use these seeds? How many do I, at every situation, maybe it's just the awareness that we're making those decisions is the difference.
Yeah, I think it really, I think, degenerated a little bit as an argument. It was an argument among philosophers that I think, in some sense, was way too demanding for what is it to have a conception of probability, is to have a whole idea of formal statistical frequency, and therefore to understand normal distributions or you know, various kinds of special distributions of possible outcomes and so on. That gets very technical very quickly. So it's perfectly possible that the Greeks never got involved with formal probability theory, although there are hints in some of the surviving mathematical works that they may have understood probability theory much more clearly than some of the philosophers thought. But you don't have to have formal frequency style probability theory in order to understand probabilities. And the, you know, the language of probability is all over Greek literature. And indeed, as some people have pointed out, it wouldn't be possible to live without some capacity of estimating probabilities. If, you know, everything in your life was a 50-50 chance and you acted that way, you'd have a short and probably rather unhappy life.
Well, and also I think, you know, this sort of probability and thinking, you know, it pops up in all sorts of different things that maybe people aren't necessarily aware of off the top of their heads, but like gambling was obviously very popular. And like my grandfather was a mathematician and he won so much money during the war because he was a card counter. But you can't imagine, like, people have been making money counting cards and dice and probably doing probability equations.
No, absolutely. I mean, we know there are basically gambling dens in the Greek world. They're rolling dice, often three dice, four dice at a time. Very complicated assessment of those probabilities. The idea that you could actually have a gambling culture with people incapable of calculating what the likelihood of a given, you know, outcome A, it's going to be, you know, seven, outcome B, it's going to be 12 if you're rolling two dice, it would be, it's kind of absurd on the face of it. So as soon as you start adding up all of the evidence, it becomes pretty clear that the Greeks did have a clear idea of this. I mean, the new idea in the book really is that it was at a very particular time and particular place, that is in Athens in the 5th century, mid to later 5th century BC, that certain people, certain intellectuals, the sophists, began to think about instrumental rationality, practical reasoning, as a skill, as a very specific skill that could be theorized, that you could actually have a whole theory of, you know, how does this work, that it could be taught, and it would give people advantage in their lives. It could be effective in politics and economic behavior and so on. That then becomes something that the Socratics, Plato and then Aristotle, pick up on and regard as both a really important discovery, but also a real threat to ethical reasoning, because the getting really good at getting what you want, if you don't want what is actually good, good for you, good for your community, can be very destructive. One of the reasons that people worry about sort of cost-benefit mathematical reasoning today is that becoming very good at this is not necessarily the thing that ends you up with a good life or a good community.
Well, and a really terrifying but palpable example, I think, in our modern world is self-driving cars. And, sure, you know, there's constant equations and there's, you know, it's a kind of the modern day trolley problem, but there's websites you can go to where they they bring up different scenarios and you vote on them. And so they're trying to compile data to figure out, because the equation changes for a self-driving car. You know, if they're avoiding one person, but you've got five people in the car, what if the person's pregnant? Or you're avoiding one person, but you crash into 20 people, you know, and trying, but they have to do these mathematical equations rather than have a person in a moment make a decision.
Yeah, yeah. And then the question is who's doing the equation and who's building it what? I mean, what if I buy, one thing that people have pointed out is, well, what if I get to have a choice about my car? I mean, I want this car to protect me no matter what. You know, I value my life more than all the other lives in the world. Do I get to dial to utterly selfish? Or do I dial it back to, you know, completely altruistic? I wouldn't want to hurt anybody in the slightest bit. I'll give up my life for even the, you know, sort of a minor inconvenience for other people, or somewhere in between. Who makes that choice? So once again, this is a really very fraught question that engages exactly in this kind of question of costs and benefits, and costs and benefits for who.
Well, and I think part of the makeup of the world, which makes it interesting, all these, is that you're going to have all the different people. You're going to have the hawks and the doves and, you know, the tits and the tats. And each time, it's not necessarily, you'll never have one situation where all the society is universally the same in their degree of selfishness and altruism.
That's right. And I think the worry that the Greek philosophers, Plato and Aristotle especially, are very clear about is that by getting good at this new theory of practical reasoning, that people were likely to become more narrowly selfish. They'll become less willing to cooperate with other people because, shoot, I can get what I want through, you know, the use of this special new technique. And so they worried it would drive out friendship, for example, or drive out kind of fellow feeling for other people. Clearly, some of the sophists, at least if we're to believe the philosophers, said, yeah, not our problem. We're teaching people how to be efficient. Yeah, they use it to dubious purposes by your philosophical standards. Well, that's don't blame us. We just teach a technique. We don't tell anybody how to use it. The worry then is that it becomes who you are. Is this very then coldly calculating, highly selfish, and very efficient at being a coldly calculating selfish person? So this was really a big challenge for Greek philosophy.
Now, I have to ask, what's the value of seeing the kind of elements of game theory in the ancient world? How do these sort of ancient examples shed light for our modern situations?
Yeah. I think partly it allows us to realize that the ancients are not as distant from us as sometimes we think. Yes, there's something magnificently alien about the ancient world. One reason we study it, we love it, because it's not just like our world. On the other hand, the people who lived in the ancient world were, I think, psychologically much closer to us than is sometimes assumed. They weren't sort of desperately foreign in the sense of not having the same kind of psychological concerns, not having the same kind of concerns about problems of cooperation that we have. I think that it allows us to see why ancient literature, why ancient mythology, why reading ancient history is so compelling to us today. It's because we do understand their motives. Their motives, their modes of reasoning are not wildly different from our own, even though other things or technology, all sorts of things really are different. And yet we can see ourselves in the ancients. And I think that, therefore, we can learn from them. Whereas if they had a completely different sort of, as it were, psychology, if they were incapable of thinking about probability, if they were not engaged in cost-benefit analysis, they would be different kind of beings. They wouldn't appeal to us because we wouldn't really be able to understand why they do whatever it is they're doing.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that in reading your book, you mentioned that Dodd's the Greek and the irrational,
yes,
and that,
yes,
you know, there's this moment of looking at the irrational aspect of the Greeks. But it, I mean, it just made me think that our modern world and our ancient world, we all have the Apollyon and the Dionysian, the rational and the irrational. There's the history of humankind is us kind of going and valleying between the two.
No, quite exactly so. I mean, this book, The Greeks and the Rational, was originally a series of lectures that I gave at University of California at Berkeley, the Sather lectures in classics. That's the same lecture series that E.R. Dodds gave that became his book,
That's great,
The Greeks and the Irrational. And so I borrowed his title and just took away two of the letters. But it's for those who are interested in classical trivia, the cover of my book is exactly it's an homage to the original cover of Dodd's book. The same, the color scheme's the same. The borrowing from Greek black figure vase painting is the same. But instead of ecstatically dancing figures on the front, I have two figures playing a strategic game, some kind of chess.
Perfect. It's like ancient Easter eggs.
That's
now.
Right.
I'd love to switch just to finish up to your outreach work, the Stanford Civics Initiative. That looks really interesting. Can you just tell us a little bit about it and what's the goal there?
Yeah, for sure. This has really began about 5 years ago. A group of Stanford faculty became concerned that the university, similar to many other great American universities, was no longer really teaching the arts of citizenship. This had been an important part of the really the founding charter of our university. And indeed, back in the early 20th century, there was a mandatory three-term course in citizenship. So we thought something like that should be put back into place. Obviously, if you study ancient Greeks, you think citizenship is pretty important, especially if you study ancient democracy, as I do. So this was pretty obvious for me. So the Civics Initiative was created to promote that idea. And we've been very successful. There is now a three-term, we have quarters rather than semesters at Stanford, three-term mandatory sequence for first-year students centered on questions of citizenship. So we got that through rather to our surprise, actually. It's a big deal changing the fundamental requirements at a major university. We also offer a whole range of other courses that are really each aimed at filling some of the gaps, as we felt they were, in the curriculum about, you know, what ought citizens to know, what skills ought they should have, what knowledge should they have. Our commitment in each of these courses is that these courses exemplify academic freedom, and they exemplify respectful interchange among people with different points of view. What we worry about is that, this is, I think, a problem with modern American citizenship, is that we're not talking with each other. And we're certainly not talking with each other as much as we should be about important questions, especially across party lines or lines of identity. So we think that the university has a real role to play in the long-term goal of trying to recover those basic skills of living together in a democratic republic that aims at some kind of a common good. And that's what the Civics Initiative is meant to do. So we've had more success than I thought we would have. We hope to continue to be building it over the next several years.
Oh, that's wonderful. And to just sort of bring it full circle, it's sort of, I suspect, I think, that modern politics has become quite elaborate game theory. So your initiative seems like the Socratic effort to sort of bring back the ethics and to discuss, you know, how we should be acting and cooperating with each other.
No, that's quite right. I mean, one of the things that in the central course of this three-quarter sequence is called Citizenship in the 21st Century. And it's very early in the course, we give them training in basic game theory because we think this is important. You should know, these are a lot of people who are using this. Yeah, this is one of the skills that is being used on you, citizens. You ought to know how it is used. That's part of it. But we also have, we read classical texts. We read some Plato. We read some early modern texts, Hobbes and so on. And also some 20th century figures, Martin Luther King. So the idea is to try to, connect the idea that there are skills you can learn. Instrumental reasoning is a very important skill, but it really does, for the Greek philosophers, need to be connected to certain ethical commitments. So that's really what the course is about.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Joshua. It was absolutely illuminating. Thank you.
Anya, delight talking with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Classical Wisdom Speaks, a podcast dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds.